From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When the subject is the infrastructure needed to rebuild America's economy, President Barack Obama isn't speaking merely of roads and bridges or even smart power grids.
It means expanding broadband lines across America so that a small business in a rural town can connect and compete with their counterparts anywhere in the world.
That'll be no mean feat. In South Korea and Hong Kong, Paris and London, internet users enjoy download speeds up to 10 times faster than commonly available here, at about a quarter of the price. And many countries have already committed themselves to providing their citizens with universal access. In terms of the connectivity required for the future of education, healthcare, technology, and commerce, not to mention downloading an iPhone app, the U.S. lags far behind much of the world. Hence, the National Broadband Plan, released this week by the Federal Communications Commission, it's an ambitious $20 billion, 10-year roadmap for redistributing the broadcast spectrum, maximizing bandwidth, lowering prices for internet, phone, and cable, and guaranteeing universal access to every mountaintop and hollow. It's also already under attack from broadcasters, business groups, and especially consumer advocates.
This is a great report by weight.
Bruce Kushnick is the chairman of Teletruth, a consumer watchdog group.
If you print it out, it's heavy. You could use it as a doorstop. Or if you play piano, you could stick it under your butt and you could sit higher on the piano stool.
Kushnick believes the broadband plan is fatally flawed because it doesn't compel the giants of phone and cable to upgrade their networks, and because, unlike in Europe, it doesn't force those telecom gorillas to lease their broadband pipes at wholesale rates to potential competitors.
That's why we can't get what you can get in Paris or London, $50 for cable and internet and phone and a network that's 10 times better than ours. It's because we don't have enough competition.
Ben Scott is the policy director for the media reform group Free Press.
And the big difference is when foreign regulators tell their incumbent telephone companies to do something, they do it. When our government tells AT&T and Verizon to do something, they sue. And we've been tied up in courts for years over these questions. So it's not surprising that the commission just said, we'll deal with this later. But that's the fundamental problem. Dealing with it later is a day late and a dollar short.
Or not. The FCC's broadband guru Blair Levin insists these issues have been well thought through.
These people saying the porridge is too hot, and others saying porridge is too cold. We think we had it about right.
When it comes to stimulating competition, he says, regulation isn't the only way to skin a cat. Another path is stimulating the sheer force of the marketplace in phone, cable, and internet. For instance, by pressuring TV stations to surrender unused or little-used spectrum for use in wireless broadband. With the development of faster so-called fourth-generation wireless technology, he says, cable companies will be under pressure to match mobile's download speeds. Meantime, on the cable TV side, gizmos that bring programming directly from the internet to your TV for free may well pressure cable to reduce the programming fee portions of everybody's overall bill.
Companies like Apple or like Google are looking at very different business models that we think will provide a very interesting kind of competition, much in the way that, say, Skype created competition for international phone calling.
Perhaps, but the scolds continue to scold. The National Association of Broadcasters is none too pleased. Having been mandated by the federal government to spend billions for the white elephant of digital television, TV stations now are being asked to surrender potentially lucrative frequencies to phone companies. And gadflies like Teletruth's Bruce Kushnick, who have howled for years about the lack of oversight on the federal subsidies to telecom, sees just another feeding frenzy ahead.
There is no regulator that takes my phone bill or your phone bill or your broadband bill and says, all right, where's all the money going and how is it being used and where's it all ending up?
Come to think of it, the only interested parties to speak approvingly of the National Broadband Plan are the cable and phone companies themselves. The National Cable and Telecommunications Association, for example, quibbled with some details but generally praised the FCC's plan, which has some people checking nervously for their wallets. the Free Press's Ben Scott.
It's kind of like the health insurance industry cheering the health care bill. How big of a reform can it be if they think it's great and they caused the problem we're trying to solve?
Another question might be, even if the FCC reaches all of its targets, what exactly will have been gained? The stated goal is universal, actual 100 megabits per second of download speed by the year 2020, which is exactly where South Korea is today. The Obama administration's stimulus package is pumping $787 billion into the U.S. economy for public works, job creation, and, yes, national broadband access. But showing exactly where that money is going is a Herculean task. Earlier this month, the White House appointed Edward Tufte to the Recovery, Accountability, and Transparency Board to make sure the website recovery.gov does the job. You may not have heard of Tufte, but you've probably reaped the benefits of his work. A longtime Yale professor, author, consultant, and data designer, Tufte has inspired a generation of innovators with his ideas for the efficient, clean, and rich presentation of information. He's a fan of the New York Times website, the iPhone, and most of all, the lowly sports page with its tables and stats a reader can grasp in an instant. But he's in a constant war with the average website, cluttered with scroll bars, logos, jargon, and meaningless graphics.
They make the simple complex. The design hand in there is from the marketing department. And it's unfortunate because our eye-brain system is so powerful. In one long glance, maybe a 12-second glance at something, probably 120 megabits of information goes to our brain. And there's no reason we have to be looking at impoverished materials because we process material at enormous rates.
Okay, so come now to your White House appointment, which is kind of a tough nut. The data among different agencies doesn't necessarily conform. They have different ways of measuring appropriations and expenditures, and it's really hard to get a fix. There's not only apples and oranges, but there's grapefruits and strawberries and kumquats out there. What's a graphics guru to do?
Probably the first thing that most people do when they go to the website is they type in their zip code. And up pops up all the stimulus projects in their area. And what's interesting about this is a huge database, and the particular viewer has no interest in 99% of it. But via the zip code, they can make it special for them, as can everybody else.
You know, I spent a little time recently on recovery.gov. And to me, you know, it doesn't look bad at all. It looks like a particularly good explainer section put together by a particularly good newspaper. You know, I think that does a pretty good job of directing me to the larger picture and also the one in my own backyard.
Terrific.
When you
That's
look
great.
At recovery.gov, do you just see 1,000 problems to be solved that I'm not seeing?
What I would most like to do is to make some additional things that are worthy of the zip code map and the data. One idea that I've been thinking of is called a flashlight map, and so you see a kind of dark blue United States with nothing on it, and then the dots, the little lights come on as each project started. That shows the spatial distribution over time of the stimulus projects. I love that you picked up the metaphor that it was like a newspaper. The first thing I said about a year ago when I met with them for the first time is that their model should be a first-rate news website.
Aha. Uh-huh. So the reason I'm not seeing so much to find fault with is because you've already been tinkering this for months before your official appointment.
Once we got the news metaphor and got the intense mapping, that's halfway there. I wouldn't give it an A yet. There's, you know, still ways to go, and I know some of them, and I hope to, you know, find a few more.
Okay, so recovery.gov is looking pretty good. You have achieved some of the clarity that you're looking for. Other government agencies are just woeful. I mean, woeful.
Yeah, the Fed's websites are not very good. The great dream of this, I think there's one chance in 10 that might happen, is that recovery.gov would become a model for all government funding. So we're now talking trillions, not this piddly $787 billion.
As the reporting of data becomes a more effective way for the government to communicate what it's up to, it seems to me also an opportunity for the politicians in the administration to go, why can't we use this as a really powerful political tool and skew the very data that you're trying to clarify?
This is not going to be a propaganda engine.
Let me put it to you a far more direct way. If Karl Rove were still the White House political operative and he had the opportunity to use cherry-picked data to sell his administration's policies, it sure would have been nice for him to have a really sweet interface.
I had once the rather shocking experience that Karl Rove mentioned the 10 most wonderful books that he ever read. And, of course, it had Machiavelli and so on. But it also had, to my mixed delight and a little bit of horror, my book with the catchy title, The Visual Display of Quantitative Information. Political practice today too often skips right by evidence and has preconceived and endlessly naive views about causality and how policies work. The government's job is to try to solve problems. I am interested in helping them solve the problem of clarifying the stimulus and also understanding the consequences of the stimulus. I'm going to do the best I can and put it out in the world, and we'll see what happens.
All right. E.T., thank you very much
for
joining us.
Good. Thank you.
Edward Tufte is author most recently of Beautiful Evidence.
Coming up, the Dirty Dozen excuses for the age-old problem of plagiarism and one possible way to end it once and for all.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your emails and tweets. We received a ton of reader mail in response to OTM producer Jamie York's piece on the so-called Uncanny Valley. That's the problem that video game designers and roboticists run into when they try to create simulations of human beings. For some reason, we're comfortable with semi-realistic representations of humans, but we find representations that are more than 96% accurate extremely creepy. Karen Schulman wrote in to say that the segment solved a long-running question she'd had about Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Quote, "I always wondered what was so off-putting about him, and now I know, the 96% problem. He's so close to being real, just not quite close enough." And a few listeners asked us for the name of the Jean-Paul Sartre essay referenced in the piece. It's called Faces.
Ernie Garner from Lake Villa, Illinois, suggests there's an audio corollary to the uncanny valley, dissonance. He says that when two notes are played far apart, the brain says no problem, A, B. And when two notes are pretty close together, the brain sees it as close enough and just hears it as one note with a changing timbre. But when the brain hears two notes that are almost exactly the same, he says, quote, "it can tell that it's not one note, but it can't clearly distinguish between the two. We feel the large amount of work the brain is doing as discomfort, dissonance. Note that anything, siblings, art, interior, design, clothing, can be dissonant as long as it meets the close but not quite criteria."
You can always email us. Go to onthemedia.org and click Contact Us at the top. Just tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Why do I always say that? Because you never do. Earlier this month, in the wake of two recent plagiarism scandals at the New York Times and at the Daily Beast website, the Times public editor Clark Hoyt called plagiarism a mortal journalistic sin. But for all the concern about one of journalism's greatest crimes, newsrooms don't seem to have any real method to deter it, at least nothing they're willing to pay for. The Columbia Journalism Review's Craig Silverman recently wrote an article championing the use of plagiarism detection software. For a fee, editors can run articles through the software, which then compares them to several databases and millions of articles on the web. Silverman believes that even the threat of random checks would be enough to greatly reduce or even eliminate incidents of plagiarism. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Any false positives in the history of this software?
I would have to think so. And in fact, it's by no means a foolproof solution. And I don't think it's the only way to detect plagiarism. But what's kind of amazing to me is that it just seems like nobody in newspapers or magazines, aside from some academic journals, are really interested in trying this.
Maybe that's because in academia, plagiarism is one of the few career ending offenses. In newspapers, historically, you could get caught and still keep your job. That has changed somewhat over the years. Do you think news organizations simply don't take the problem that seriously?
If you read the codes of ethics for professional organizations in journalism, if you read the statements of principles at pretty much any newspaper that bothers to put them down on paper, plagiarism is basically akin to a sin in journalism. It is really that bad and that awful. And I suppose if you do it on purpose, it is supposed to be a career killer. The problem seems to be actually acting on those words where we don't actually do anything to prevent it. And of course, as you said, when it happens, people are treated differently.
For example, the New York Times, Zachary Coey, a business writer, resigned having been caught lifting passages from Wall Street Journal reporting on his beat. But about a year ago, Maureen Dowd was in a similar fix, and, you know, she's still writing her column.
To be fair to Maureen Dowd, we're talking about one sentence, one time, in one column. With the other reporter, they found repeated instances of taking stuff without attribution. But I also think that there has to be an element of prevention here. And why not use some technology to actually help people avoid the accidental plagiarism, which is pretty much anyone who's caught, they say, oh, it was not really on purpose.
You just used the term accidental plagiarism. Do you think that any of these episodes has anything to do with accident? Any of them? Ever?
I think it's BS most of the time. But for somebody who really one time forgot to put some quotes around something or forgot to paraphrase something, it would be a shame for them to have that go into print when it could be caught beforehand and fixed.
Do you think readers really care?
We tell readers that it's unacceptable, and we tell readers that we won't do it. So whether they rank it high or not, the fact is that we declare to people that it's really that important.
Is routinely putting your staff's work through the plagiarism machine not kind of like frisking them every day as they leave the office to see if they're absconding with office supplies? I mean, isn't there this kind of presumption of guilt that's a little gross?
Instead of comparing it to that, I would actually compare it to, say, drug testing that goes on in professional sports. If you think about it, people have their work checked in college when they're in journalism school. So it's kind of like if the NFL knew that people were tested in the NCAA, but when they got to the NFL, there was no testing required anymore. If plagiarists are such a bad thing and they're a brand killer and a morale killer, why wouldn't we just try a few things that can actually deter them or catch them?
Your piece is predicated on the notion that newspapers have not widely embraced this software, but some have bought it and are using it. What are their experiences?
A couple of years ago, I spoke with a person at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and he told me they were using a service, and they were doing sort of random checks with it. And the interesting thing about what he told me was people in the newsroom knew they were going to be testing stuff. And the fact that they never actually caught a plagiarist, he said after a while, people in the newsroom started looking at it as a good thing because for them, it was reinforcing that, hey, we have an ethical, good newsroom. We're good reporters.
You mean like I live in East Germany and Stasi's got my back. Thank God for the secret police. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying, but that's a good way to take it in a completely different direction. What I'm saying is basically people don't like working with plagiarists. They don't like what that does to their reputation and the kind of effect it can have on their work. So if you're doing this and people are, you know, not really getting busted for plagiarism, then all of a sudden you can feel a lot more confident about the kind of newsroom you have.
If the service is as invaluable as you suggest, why do you suppose that newspapers haven't jumped at it?
For the most part, it's a cost issue. And that's really understandable, especially right now. I got a quote from Authenticate, which is just one of many services. You're looking at spending probably between $5,000 and $10,000 a year on that service. There are other ones that are much less expensive. Comparatively, that's quite affordable to avoid an incident of plagiarism. But the reality is that $5,000 or $10,000 for most news organizations right now, they see that as a lot of money and a very prohibitive cost.
Craig, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is a columnist for the Columbia Journalism Review and editor of the blog RegretTheError.com.
Throughout plagiarism's long and tawdry history, there's one element that seems to tie all the crimes together, the excuses. Slate's Jack Schaefer, who identified Gerald Posner's plagiarism at the Daily Beast last month, has compiled what he calls the Dirty Dozen rationalizations which crop up time after time with a stunning, if unsurprising, lack of originality. Jack, welcome back to the show.
You betcha.
So how did you formulate your list of excuses?
A Slate reader named Michael Clark, who's a historian, sent me his list of the most common excuses he'd experienced while teaching. He gave me six, and I added another six onto that to come up with a dirty dozen.
Many of the dirty dozen excuses, I guess, are intended to garner some sympathy for the plagiarist.
Well, all of them seem to tap the forgiveness in the human soul.
And among some of the specific sympathy ones, you've got, I was really tired. That's number 10. Number 12. I was young and inexperienced. I love the first excuse the best, though. I have no reason to plagiarize.
It's a lot about switching the subject. I have no reason to plagiarize. I'm very accomplished. I did all the reporting. Why would I lift four or five consecutive sentences? So it's one of the things that the plagiarist does to bamboozle the people that he's trying to give the excuse to.
You talk about the banality of plagiarism.
There is a school of plagiarist who says, well, there was nothing really all that special. It wasn't Proustian language that I was boosting. It was just sort of flat description, or it wasn't very distinguished, or wasn't very literary. They're basically saying, these words are up for grabs. I can call them my own and make the reader think that they're reading something original by lifting these everyday pedestrian words. The thing about everyday pedestrian words is it sometimes takes hours and hours and hours to do the reporting, to write a pedestrian two or three sentences.
Another class of the dirty dozen are the excuses that are meant to suggest that it really isn't plagiarism at all because the intention wasn't there. I didn't intend to do it. Or, as you mentioned, it was only boilerplate or wire copy.
The intention excuse presents this case for cryptoamnesia, that they took something, but they don't recall it. The boilerplate excuse annoys me because the guy who created the boilerplate had to work really hard to produce that. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you're so upset about plagiarism because it's stealing writers' work. That doesn't bother me as much as the fraud that it foists off on readers.
Well, let me challenge that, because my feeling is, as a reader, that if the information is important and if the provenance is secure, for instance, if somebody steals some AP copy but doesn't credit it, it doesn't matter that much to me. It's really the writers that care about getting ripped off.
But how does the plagiarist know that that which he has lifted in its new context is true information? The plagiarist, even when he lifts a clean and factual set of sentences and places them in a new context, he doesn't really know the deeper meaning of those.
Yeah, but you don't solve that problem merely by crediting the source.
No, but you give the reader a way to make a migration back to the original information to check it himself. I've always believed that the best journalism is reproducible.
Like scientific experiments?
Like a scientific experiment, that given similar tools, similar sourcing, a similar budget, you could go and interview the same people and come up with a very, very similar story that would confirm the original story. This is a radical assertion on your part. You're defending plagiarism on what grounds?
I'm not defending it. I am just saying that in the list of journalistic felonies, it doesn't play that high in my book.
What is the list of felonies?
Making things up is like number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 through 12. And number 13 is plagiarism, because it's a sin of vanity rather than a capital offense.
No, I think it's a moral failing, and it's a violation of the trust that's shared by the reporter, the editor, the publisher of the information, and the reader. I think that journalism, except when there is attribution, comes with almost a contractual promise that the material is original.
Don't misunderstand me. I don't think that this is an acceptable practice. Mm-hmm. I just find it often put in the same category as making things up.
Let's say that what you lifted was a quotation, but the implication was that the quotation was given to the reporter. Isn't that making something up? Many times plagiarists lift quotations and make it appear as though it was their enterprise that went and got this interview. And I don't see how it's not making things up to grab material from outside of a context and place it inside a new context.
Actually, I think you convinced me that I'm wrong, that there is no line between plagiarism and fabrication.
Really? Now I have to talk you out of it. I've taken you too far. I'm too persuasive.
Thank you, Jack.
It was fantastic.
Jack Schaefer is Slate's editor at large. Our friend Mike Pesca, erstwhile OTM producer, now NPR correspondent, wrote about the stealing of words when he was co-hosting the show a few years ago. The references are a bit dated, but his point still stands. Plagiarism is eternal.
Was this the face that launched a thousand ships?
Today, we end with the bard. Or at least a bard, because that was Christopher Marlowe writing about Helen of Troy. This is Shakespeare writing about Helen of Troy.
She is a pearl whose price hath launched above a thousand ships.
Marlowe.
Holla, ye pampered jades of Asia. What, can ye draw but 20 miles a day?
Shakespeare.
And hollow pampered jades of Asia, which cannot go but 30 miles a day.
Marlowe died before any of those Shakespearean plays were written. Some people, such as the producers of the PBS special from which those clips were lifted, have concluded that the similarities mean Shakespeare was Marlowe. The less radical interpretation is that Shakespeare was a plagiarist. Such a charge in Elizabethan England would result in scratched heads, and not just because of the prevalence of lice. Back then, plagiarism was no big deal. Fair was foul and foul was fair, as Shakespeare probably stole from Ben Jonson. Aristotle stole from Democritus. Homer stole from folklore. Virgil stole from Homer. The point is, getting one's papyrus in a twist over plagiarism is a relatively recent phenomenon. This week alone, University of Colorado professor and 9/11 victim antagonist Ward Churchill was found to be a plagiarist. And an NBC producer writing about the Kentucky Derby stole not just a phrase, but the idea of repeating the phrase after a pause. After a pause. Of course, the most picked over case is that of Harvard freshman Kavah Viswanathan, who got $500,000 for writing How Opal Mehta Got Kissed, Got Wild, and Got a Life, a book that had the unfortunate quality of having already been written. A reading from Megan McCafferty's Sloppy Seconds.
But in a truly sadomasochistic dieting gesture, they chose to buy their Diet Cokes at Cinnabon.
And from Opal Mehta.
In a truly masochistic gesture, they had decided to buy Diet Cokes from Mrs. Fields.
As a truly sadomasochistic gesture, I can read to you a couple dozen more of those parallelisms, but then I'd ruin the literary experience. Suffice it to say, the outrage against the teenaged author was swift and furious, and deservedly so. She, James Fry, Jason Blair, cheats and liars all, a pox on all their houses. Shakespeare, but probably also John Webster. Of course, journalists who have bylines tend to be more aggrieved by instances of plagiarism than the layman. The consumer probably has an Elizabethan mindset about all this. No big deal. Because when you think about it, how can the layman possibly keep up? Can he watch a TV report and definitively say it was written by the on-screen correspondent or by an off-screen producer? Can he watch a movie and be sure the credited screenwriter wrote the lines? Or was it one of the dozen scribes who punch up every script? And that DJ's beat, his own, or a Casey and the Sunshine Band track from the 70s? None of those things are theft, but it convinces the consumer that a byline might just be a vestige of a bygone era. The last big institution holding the line against plagiarism is the Academy. Doris Kearns Goodwin seriously hurt her status as a historian when she plagiarized, but as a television commentator and author of page-turning biographies, we can forgive her trespasses, to quote the King James Bible, which was written by a team of writers stealing from God. I predict that in 20 years, whatever version there is of Wikipedia will refer to plagiarism as a short-lived concept in the history of communication. Eventually, the open-source reference guide will say, plagiarism, once seen as a dire pitfall, came to be discounted as a sin. Eventually, plagiarists were treated like hack comics. You can steal a joke, but you can't steal a career. And you can quote me on that. Or feel free to pass the thought on as your own, especially if I'm wrong.
Mike Pesca offered those ruminations on OTM in 2006. Coming up, why you may be hearing fewer tapes of 9/11 calls on your nightly news and cultural cliches we love to hate.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. TV producers love to play recordings of dramatic 911 calls. Last week, the most played recording was probably one of a 7-year-old boy named Carlos who hid in a bathroom to call 911 while his parents were being robbed at gunpoint. In that case, the robbers heard the kid, fled, and no one was hurt. But calls with tragic endings get played endlessly, too. So out of concern for the victim's privacy, states like Missouri and Pennsylvania keep tapes of emergency calls private. Ohio, Wisconsin, and Alabama are considering doing the same. Sonny Brassfield is the executive director of Alabama's Association of County Commissions. He says if you're not a public figure, your emergency calls should be private.
The legislation pending in Alabama says that the audio recording of a 911 call would only be released upon the order of a court saying that the public's right to know exceeded the person's right to privacy.
Now, I have to ask you about your premise that someone who dials 911 has a right of privacy. My understanding was that when you are in contact with a law enforcement agency, that it is a public record, and that it's part of the deal from that point forward.
Whether something is a public record in each state, of course, is determined by that state's legislature. Here in Alabama, our open records law uses the word writing, a public writing, and so there has been some debate here as to whether or not the audio recording of a 911 call would be a public writing. And so the bill does go on to provide that the written transcript of the call would automatically be accessible for anyone. Now, you do, I think, strike at the heart of the matter, and that is, does a citizen who is otherwise not a public figure automatically lose their rights by dialing 911 to ask for help? And my opinion is very strong that a citizen who's outside their grandmother's being attacked by someone's dog, I don't believe that citizen loses their right to privacy by calling 911 for help.
Tell me, what was the straw that broke the camel's back on this one?
Last March in Geneva County, there were some tragic murders down there and where a man drove around in about a 30-mile area and killed 4 people. And those calls were almost immediately utilized by the news media. That was probably the issue that brought it into focus here in Alabama, but there had been a couple of other awful occurrences as well.
Yeah, well, this is a conundrum. You know, I must say my sympathies lie with the poor victims for whom these tapes are often gigantic insult heaped atop unspeakable injury. But one of the reasons the news media are in general against this kind of legislation is that we will have lost the opportunity to know how well our first responders are responding. Is that not a reasonable fear?
I think it certainly is a reasonable concern. And our legislation differs a little in that we state up front affirmatively that a transcript of the call is a public record, as well as all the other related data, the times that the call came in, the times that first responders were dispatched, what time they arrived on the scene. That data is public record. We are really focused on the voice of the person who has made the 911 call. And at least from our association here in Alabama, the county commissions are never going to support anything that would shield public knowledge about inefficiencies or failure.
You say that with some confidence. My experience is that governments, given the opportunity to avoid embarrassment or worse, will use any means at their disposal to avoid the opprobrium of the public.
Well, I think you do raise a point, but we're talking about a very small subset of the calls, those calls that do not involve a criminal investigation and do not involve a public figure. And honestly, on those calls, I think the public is well served by us to stop long enough to have consideration and debate on whether or not we should protect their rights.
I suppose if news media had exercised just a modicum of taste and restraint when given the opportunity to air this very graphic audio, we might not be having this conversation.
I think that's a fair statement, and my background is in news. But we also have to recognize that there are other ways that these recordings are disseminated other than through what you and I would consider legitimate news organizations. Some of the calls are available for people to hear all over websites around the world, and I'm not so sure that most of the people that operate those ponder restraint very much at all.
Well, I must say in this particular case, I don't trust the media and I don't trust the commissioners. Either way, I think this is a lose-lose situation.
If you are a regular citizen who makes that call for 911, I think you lose today. People all over the world can listen to your intimate words on the worst day of your life.
Well, Sonny, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Sonny Brassfield is Executive Director of the Association of County Commissions of Alabama. Darryl Pinckney is a writer and journalist. He's the author of the loosely autobiographical novel High Cotton and has been a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books for more than 30 years. Pinckney was also, for a time, a fiercely ardent fan of the long-running CBS soap opera
Jack, this isn't something that I wanted to have to tell you.
As the World Turns.
That's not exactly true. I want you to know it.
In 2008, he saw some short excerpts on YouTube of the gay on-screen romance between two young characters, Luke and Noah, and he was hooked. Pinckney bought a TV.
What's going on?
Which he hadn't owned for years for the express purpose of watching ATWT, as fans of the show call it. He joined the official fan club and attended events like Soap Fest for a chance to meet the actors. Darryl, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Okay, first of all, really? Really? You became hooked on the show and then decided to write about it? This isn't some sort of journalistic project that began with you on assignment getting immersed in As the World Turns?
No, honestly. It took me by surprise, and once I was into it, I thought, this is a world very different from what I usually am sort of exploring culturally. And after a while, I was sort of trying to explain it to myself, and I was just talking to a friend who happened to be an editor, and she said, explore it for us. And this was after I'd been watching for some time.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, this is kind of down market for you. The New York Review of Books ain't exactly soap opera digest.
Oh, yeah?
Now, was this slumming? Or did you have some academic interest in this? How do you get hooked on something so plebeian?
Ooh, you can get hooked on plot. You can get hooked on character, high and low. And, you know, the high stuff runs pretty much along the same motives as the low stuff, really. I think that watching this kind of series took the place of a sort of fiction I used to read.
This was the pulp in your diet.
If you want to call it that. I sort of don't want to talk down to the genre or other fans or even my own interest.
Well, don't worry about running down the show or the other fans. I'll be happy to assume the role of the obnoxious snob for you. Give me a synopsis of the various things that happened to Luke both before and after you started watching the series.
He was passing for straight with the help of his black cousin. When he finally told his best friend the truth, his best friend sort of beat him up. Then his best friend nearly drowned, but Luke saved him. And while he was saving him, his other best friend's sister was killing everyone at the camp. Then he started drinking, and then he needed a kidney, and the only guy who could give him a kidney blackmailed his mother into sort of promising to marry him and things like that.
Yeah, and you didn't want to be on the record as disrespecting the genre, but let's just move past that. I know you are aware that Luke and Noah don't actually exist, that it's pretend.
I'm barely aware of it.
Was it easier for you to see how soap opera aficionados could kind of lose the line between fantasy and reality? I know if you read letters to Soap Opera Digest, the letters are written to the characters, not necessarily to the actors playing them.
The ones who were deep into it that I sort of hung out with at the luncheon and then at Soapfest in Florida, I don't think they had any trouble constructing boundaries. They were very protective of the actors and their privacy. I sort of went to these things thinking there was some magical door somewhere to Oakdale. Because when you're watching on YouTube or even on your own TV by yourself, you can fall into thinking that it's just between kind of you and them. So actually meeting other fans brought me back down to earth. That's the strange thing.
You, at some point in your piece in Harper's, revealed that you had a somewhat academic interest in how the issues of gay sexuality, especially among young people, could be played out in the cultural mainstream. And did this at any point overcome your basic visceral obsession with the characters and the plots?
Eventually, in the sense that our side, as it were, lost. The show's been canceled, and they never developed the Luke and Noah story in the way their fans wanted them to.
I must ask you, though, you have spent most of your life in the kind of, I don't know, sexual equivalent of Jim Crow. And on As the World Turns, there were young gay men kissing. I mean, if 20 years ago, could you even have imagined that?
No. These kind of gay images were coded or highbrow or late night or camp, but nothing was sort of just straightforward and normal. And in this unlikely corner of the market, this was happening and could happen. And somehow this day-by-day excursion into a place where no one expected me to be, least of all myself, was very comforting. So I am grateful for the experience. It's just, you know, as you said, they're not real. So there's only so far it can go.
All right, Darryl. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Darryl Pinkney is the author of the novel High Cotton. His piece, Lonely Hearts Club, appears in the February issue of Harper's.
On the next, As the World Turns.
You're all I want.
Are you seriously considering having a child with Janet?
It's hard to find a reason not to.
Soap operas are both loved and hated for their use of outlandish plot devices, introducing an evil identical twin or bringing a character back from the dead. These are just a couple of soap opera tropes cataloged on the website tvtropes.org, an online wiki where contributors collaborate to identify tropes in everything from literature to film to pop music. The list is exhaustive and delightful. For example, there's the trope dubbed arson, murder, and jaywalking, where a character ends a list of three or more things with a pretty weak example.
Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together.
Zachary Pincus Roth wrote about TV tropes for the LA Times. Zachary, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
Tell me, what's the origin of the site?
It came out of this discussion website for Buffy the Vampire Slayer called Buffistas. One of the guys on that site, his name is Fast Eddie, decided, well, why don't we create a site that talks about all these repeated patterns we see on TV, and it took off. Now there are over 20,000 tropes.
What's amazing about it is that it's so comprehensive and so spot on.
Yeah, definitely. There are things that you sort of have always thought about in your head but never heard articulated. There's one called the suspiciously specific denial, where a denial is so specific that it's clearly a lie. The one that I remember from my childhood is from the movie Spaceballs, which is a Star Wars parody. Rick Moranis' character. He's sort of the Darth Vader figure. He's playing with his dolls in his office. Someone interrupts him.
Not next time! Yes, sir! Did you see anything?
No, sir! I didn't see you playing with your dolls again!
Good!
And what I think is very amusing about the page on TV tropes for suspiciously specific denials is they list tropes from all media, so it can range from anime to film to movies to theater to professional wrestling. One of the examples is also the lyrics from the Kanye West song, "Now I Ain't Saying She's a Gold Digger." That is also a very suspiciously specific denial. And somehow a Kanye West song can relate to Spaceballs, I think is one of the great things about the site.
As you sifted through this incredible avalanche, what was your favorite trope?
It's called, I'll take offense to that last one, which is a comedy trope where person A lists a series of flaws of person B, and then person B says, "I am not," and they name one of the flaws, therefore implying that all of the other ones are in fact true. The famous one is in The Empire Strikes Back. Princess Leia says to Han Solo,
"Why, you stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder!"
Who's scruffy-looking?
So you find it in such frothy entertainments as The Empire Strikes Back and Pirates of the Caribbean, but also Citizen Kane.
"You long-faced, overdressed anarchist!"
"I am not overdressed."
"You are too!"
You mentioned that there was a rift among the contributors, dividing them into the lumpers and the splitters?
Yeah. Basically, lumpers are people who like to lump tropes together, and splitters are people who like to take a larger trope and break it down into its component parts.
Give me an example of lumping and splitting.
There's a bunch of hair tropes. You could lump them together into sort of, you know, hair changes, but they're actually broken down into multiple different tropes. For instance, there's a difference between the important haircut, the expository hairstyle change, and the hair reboot.
Well, in Shanghai Noon, when Jackie Chan's ponytail gets chopped off by his nemesis, I guess that means he must reconcile himself to staying in the West.
"Now you can never go back to China."
"Whew, you blew it, man. He did not want to cut his hair off, trust me."
Is that an expository haircut?
That would actually be the important haircut.
Oh.
When a character cuts off their hair to symbolize something or to show character growth. The expository hairstyle change is more like in a movie like Castaway, where you see a character with like a long scruffy beard and their hair is much longer, and it just sort of shows the passage of time to sort of save them from showing exposition.
Another whole set of tropes have to do with dialogue. One of them that they note is, "If you will excuse me, I have a noun to verb."
Yeah, that one is usually after a villain has finished explaining his evil plan and is about to go execute that plan.
"Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a city to destroy."
Another one of those rhetorical tropes is one-liner, name, one-liner. You know, in Babe, Farmer Hoggett says,
"That'll do, Pig. That'll do."
But there are actually dozens and dozens of them.
Run, Forrest, run!
Game over, man. It's game over.
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
Do you think that tropes are instructive? Do they tell us something about how we see the world? Or is it part of a private joke that the writers have with every single member of its audience?
There is sort of a question about whether tropes are things that appeal to an audience or things that just writers like to do. But sometimes things do show up in people's real lives. And actually on this website, there's a section called Troper Tales where people talk about where tropes have shown up in their own life.
A lot of the examples involve anime, a lot of science fiction citations, comics, and so forth. Do you think this website could ever go mainstream when it's got such clearly nerdy contributors?
I think the site is becoming more mainstream, and there are growing examples of, you know, classic films and theater and other media. And I think it would be great if it did go mainstream and become more comprehensive.
I think it already is. It's already hugely comprehensive and just enormously witty.
Yeah, no, definitely. Witty and snarky and makes fun of these tropes, but also in many ways loves them. It's a very entertaining site.
Well, Zachary, thank you for bringing it to our attention.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Zachary Pincus Roth is a freelance writer in Los Angeles. He wrote his article on TV tropes for the Los Angeles Times.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Peter Henderson, and Lynn Davis, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm her evil twin, Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.